with the interactions that they feel. There's sort of four forces of nature that we know of. There's gravity, there's the strong nuclear force that binds together the nuclei of atoms. Then there's the weak nuclear force, okay? And then there's electromagnetism. Now, everything feels gravity. Like, gravity is so weak on particle, in particle terms, it's almost impossible to observe any effect of gravity on particles. The only reason that we think of gravity as strong is because gravity always adds up to the same sign. And so we feel the pull from all the particles in the Earth. And it's only by having that huge number of particles that it's strong enough to even feel it. The other forces act at much shorter ranges, strong force acts at a much shorter range, weak force acts at a much shorter range, and the electromagnetic force, you have half plus and half minus. So the effect of this is that the strong force, which binds together the nuclei of atoms, is very strong. The electromagnetic force also has a strength. The weak force is has an extremely small effect on particles. If you think about, you know, glass, see, you know, through glass, because the light doesn't interact very much with the glass, it goes right through it. However, if you had a piece of glass that was a foot thick, it would start to look dark. But if you had a piece of glass that was 100 feet thick, it would see through. So the light does interact with the glass, just not very much. It's the same effect, but carried to a much greater extent with a neutrino. The Earth is far more transparent than any piece of glass. As Frank says, you need light years of lead to have the effect of an inch of glass.
So it only, we only know it when it reacts with the, when we see a reaction, and then there's a way of spotting it then. And they began to get underway doing that, thinking about it properly, in the 1930s. But Susan Cartwright, in 1956, the Eureka moment, the neutrinos were detected for the first time.
Achieved using the reverse of the reaction that first caused Pauling to believe that neutrinos existed. In beta decay, a neutron turns into a proton and it emits an electron and this mysterious neutrino. And in the 1950s, Fred Linus in Los Alamos realized that the inverse process was also possible. If you hit a neutron with a neutrino, you can get a proton out, a proton and an electron, or if you hit a proton with a neutrino, you can get a neutron and a positron. And the key fact is that a positron, being the antiparticle of an electron, will annihilate matter, producing radiation which you can detect. And the neutron, a little bit later, will be captured and will also produce radiation. So he figured if he could get a sufficiently intense source of anti-neutrinos, he could detect this reaction that converts a proton to a neutron. At first, being at Los Alamos, he thought he might use a bomb. The difficulty with using a bomb is having your experiment survive the experience. So although he did get quite far in planning an experiment using a bomb, he had plans to drop it down a shaft so that it wouldn't be vaporized by the shockwave and then have feathers and things at the bottom to prevent it from smashing into bits. Eventually, he realized that the next most intense source is this explosion. He won the Nobel Prize! A shame for a long time later, but he did win the Nobel Prize.
It was the feathers that got me. Sorry, I interrupted your flow. Right.
So, realised the bomb idea having obvious drawbacks, he realised that the next most intense source of neutrinos was a nuclear power reactor, that the fission fragments are not stable and they decay by a relative beta decay and produce vast numbers of antineutrinos. So he figured he could use a reactor. He wrote a letter to Enrico Fermi saying that he had this idea. He previously discussed the bomb idea with Fermi as well. And Fermi wrote a lovely letter back saying, I think this is a much better idea. For a start, you'll be able to repeat the experiment.
Sorry,
so, he built what, for the time, in the 1950s, 1950s when experiments were literally tabletop instruments, he built what was then considered a very large detector. In these days of LHC, large detectors are the size of a small office block. But in those days, his detector was probably the size of this room, not even, maybe the size of this table.
Ordinary table.
About a cubic meter. You could just about get a person inside it, because one of the things he did when testing it was measure the radioactivity of a person caused by potassium-40 in your cells. This was, by the standards of the time, an enormous experiment. He had difficulty persuading people it would work. But that's what you need to detect neutrinos, very large detectors by the standards of your time.
So he was on the track of the neutrinos, but by then scientists had already worked out, as I understand it, that the sun produced far and away the largest number of neutrinos. Why is that the case?
Well, the sun, as Frank said, is a nuclear furnace, and the way it generates energy is it converts hydrogen into helium. Now, hydrogen is pure protons. Helium is two protons plus two neutrons. So to convert hydrogen into helium, you must convert two protons into two neutrons. And this is, in fact, exactly the same reaction that Fred Myers used to discover it the neutrino in the first place. And every time you turn a proton into a neutron, you get a neutrino out as a necessary byproduct. And the sun is converting protons into neutrons at the rate of about 10 to the power 38, that's one followed by 38 zeros, every second. And every time a neutrino is spat out. And whereas the light, the energy that is produced in the core of the sun, takes about a million years to make it to the surface, because, as we just discussed, neutrinos don't actually notice matter much, the neutrinos get light from the centre to the surface in a couple of seconds, and 8 minutes later, they're at your detector.
Right. I'm going to pause to try to think on that after that one. Frank Close.
My love is a mountainside, so firm, so firm it can calm the tide. My love for you is a mountainside, stand so firm it can calm the tide. That's why my love is a mountainside. My love is an ocean's roar. So strong that I can't let you go. My love for you is an ocean's roar. Grows so strong that I can't let you go. That's why my love is an ocean's roar. My love is longer than forever, endless as the march of time. 99 years after never, in my heart you'll still be mine. 'Cause my love is a deep blue sea. So deep that I'll never be free. My love for you is a deep blue sea, grown so strong that I'll never be free. That's why my love is a deep blue sea. My love is a deep blue sea. My love is a deep blue sea. My love is a deep blue sea.